standard issue for all women.
Hello, Jen here to tell you about this week's episode of The Sunday Chops. But before I do, look, we don't like to talk about it, but we have a Patreon page which you can currently subscribe to listen to episodes such as this a little bit early and without adverts. We've got more exclusive content coming for our Patreon subscribers and a whole host of other bits and bobs in the very near future. So if that sounds like something you might enjoy, you know what to do. You'll find us at patreon.com/standard issue. We thank you in advance. Back to this episode, in which I was joined by Elaine Lynn Herring, Harvard Law School lecturer, consultant, speaker, and author of the new book Unlearning Silence: How to Speak Your Mind, Unleash Talent, and Lead with Courage. Elaine was inspired to write the book after she realised that having a seat at the table doesn't necessarily mean you get heard, with potentially huge consequences in work and in life. This week, I chatted to her about how we learn silence, why silence disproportionately impacts certain groups, how to unlearn it, and the myth of imposter syndrome. Controversial. I hope you enjoy it as much as I enjoyed speaking to Elaine. I am joined by Elaine Lynn Herring, lecturer at Harvard Law School, speaker and author of the new book Unlearning Silence: How to Speak Your Mind, Unleash Talent and Lead with Courage. Elaine, hello.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thank you for joining me. I'm very interested in the topic of this book, and you've had some major props for it. There's a lovely quote on the front comparing you to Brené Brown. How does that feel?
Hopeful. Helpful and accurate, hopefully, in that when I set out to write this book, the vision was to put silence on the map the way that Brené Brown put shame on the map. She was not the first person to research shame. She was not the first person to write about it. But her conversation and contribution meant that we talk about shame all the time. We know it's a thing. We solve for it. We try to solve for it. And that really is my hope with silence. Silence is real. It's part of our lives. We have a name for it. We can solve for it together.
Okay. So this seems like a good point to start off with. If you could tell me a little bit about your book.
Yeah. The book was born out of a frustration with the common advice that many of us get, which is just speak up in the workplace. If you want to be visible, if you want to get promoted, you need to speak up. If you're not being heard, the problem is you. Go fix yourself. And that advice that I received, that I have given, felt wholly unsatisfying and at times irresponsible. So unlearning silence is, well, why don't we speak up? What makes it difficult? And spoilers, it's not just us. It's not a fix yourself situation. So the book explores silence, the ways that we edit ourselves, the ways that we feel like we have to edit ourselves, the ways that we have learned to stay silent and been rewarded for staying silent. And we didn't just make it up. The people around us, our well-intentioned leaders and managers, continue to silence us while saying, I'm here to support you and my door is always open. And of course, silence is baked into all the policies and practices that make up the systems we're all part of. My hope is that if we can name the problem more accurately, we have a much better chance at actually solving it.
Okay. Could you tell us a little bit about your sort of professional background and what drew you to this? Like, where did you see silence in particular that led you to this topic?
I spent more than a decade teaching leadership development workshops, skills for negotiating, having difficult conversations, giving and receiving feedback, all concepts out of the Harvard Negotiation Project, tools that I think are useful. And yet, after tremendous investment, financial and energy from companies and individuals, some people still wouldn't negotiate, still wouldn't have the difficult conversations, still wouldn't give or receive feedback, no matter how much their manager or HR begged them to. So I asked the question, what gives? Why is that? And the underlying force there is silence. If we have learned silence, then to just say, well, build these skills on top of it, when fundamentally there is still gravity and an undercurrent keeping us silent, then we're not going to be able to negotiate and do all these other things, those essential communication skills, which is why the title is Unlearning Silence. How do we excavate what we might have learned that has become habit, those unconscious assumptions that actually hold us back and also limit our teams and the people around us, while we, in our heart of hearts, and genuinely say to them, I'm here to support you. That's not how they feel. That's not how they experience us.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because obviously you talk about it, your background in it, or the things that have drawn you to this subject are from a sort of like business and leadership perspective, but it's something that is across our whole lives, professional, personal, etc. And I wonder, like, are you able to put these things into practice yourself? Is that something you had to work at, or have you always been sort of able to, I don't know, call things out, I suppose?
Oh no. Let me go there. Meaning, there's so much. Everyone says you write the book that you needed when you were younger. Mm-hmm. I did do that. I also wrote the book that I still need. So I am the youngest daughter of an immigrant family from Taiwan to the United States. I grew up in the Christian church. So that means a lot of turn the other cheek, be the other person, suppress your own needs and thoughts for the collective good. And of course, being a woman means I'm less important than a man because patriarchy. Mm-hmm. And to respect my elders means to keep my mouth shut. To ask a question, either for clarification or to push thoughts forward, means to be disrespectful. So I learned silence. You know, I think we all learn different variations of silence from the time we were young, of when we were told to shut up, when they didn't even have to tell us to shut up, just the look. Mm. You know, the eyes.
The look I give my daughter, yeah.
Well, and that I give my son. Mm. Really? Really? And there's such a balance, because we are teaching them, our children, the next generation, how to be thoughtful human beings, or at least I like to think that we are, right? You don't just, speaking up isn't just shooting off your mouth whenever you want. We are still considering the impact on other people. But is there an over-rotation where we self-censor before we even let the thought form? And also that not everyone has the same relationship with silence. So then certain voices dominate in social and political discourse, or at work, or even at home. And if in our families, the places where we should be able to be most true to ourselves, we can't actually have our needs met, then what are we doing here? Yeah. So this is very much I am a work in progress in terms of unlearning silence. The biggest surprise for me in writing this book is I actually do have a voice. That was not something I believed or knew before this process started.
It's interesting, because within my family dynamic, I am the one who will say, well, why are we all ignoring this? Like, this is ridiculous. Should we have a chat about this massive elephant in the room? And as a result, I have, I would say, a bit of a reputation within my family for being a quote-unquote drama queen. Oh, she's just being dramatic. Oh, she's just like, that's just what she's like, blah, 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 blah. Yep. Whereas I think I'm the one who, I don't like conflict, and I've gotten better at it as I've gotten older in terms of, like, when it's important to say something and when, you know, it's maybe things need a bit more sugarcoating. I've definitely, you know, honed it a bit as I've gotten older.
You've had a higher sugar diet as you've gotten older.
Yeah. Speaking up does come at a cost sometimes, doesn't it? I'm not sure the world is ready for a lack of silence. What do you think about that?
And the book is not called Say Everything All the Time. Mm. The book is called Unlearning Silence. And chapter 3 specifically is when silence makes sense. Unlearning silence does not mean saying everything all the time to everyone. The world is far too noisy and far too complex for that. And there is utility to silence. I would argue we actually need more pauses, those strategic pauses between stimulus and response, where reflective thinking, where slow thinking can happen rather than reactive or fast thinking. And this is the big and mm-hmm. of, do we actually each get to use our voices? Do we get to have coherent thoughts of our own? Do we get our needs met? Do we have to hide parts of our identity because the team, the circumstance, the community around us doesn't accept us and can only, we are only palatable if we fit into the stereotype and bias that they hold about us.
Mm.
And it is not just work for me to speak up. It is how do we as leaders, as people who care about each other, create space for difference? And in the family dynamic that you mentioned, if Jen is always going to speak up, then everyone else sort of gets a pass, meaning I don't have to say it because I know Jen will. And it's exhausting for the Jens of the world because you're always having to raise it and then you get labeled as dramatic. And because you have a reputation, then it's much more likely that there she goes again.
Yeah.
Right. And I sort of tune you out because here's another one of those things.
The squeaky wheel and all that.
The squeaky wheel versus, and I think that to me, the fundamental principle of the book is agency. The difference between silence that is additive or oppressive is agency. Do I get to choose when I want to use my voice, when I want to speak up versus I feel obligated to do it or I feel obligated to stay silent because the only way I can stay in this relationship is to keep my mouth shut. The only way I can keep my seat at the table is to keep my mouth shut. That to me is the difference. So it is absolutely not say everything you think.
Mm.
In fact, if we look at the social systemic dynamic, whose voices gets heard? Who are we relying on? Thank you, Jen, for bearing the brunt in that dynamic, right?
What a hero and I am.
And what might need to change for it to be more sustainable for everyone?
Yeah. This stuff about children is interesting because children will just say whatever comes into their head, right? And like my daughter yesterday on the way home from nursery, she's staring over the road at this kind of like quite loud family who are going past. And she's staring at them. And I'm like, Lyra, what are you doing? Don't stare at people. It's a bit rude. Like, blah, blah, blah. She's like, I'm interested in that family. And I was like, why, darling? And she's like, I don't think I want to talk like her. I think I want to talk like you. And I was like, okay, that's lovely. But like, maybe just, you know, let's save this chat for when we get home kind of thing. Because I'm worried they're going to hear and be offended, obviously. Mm. And children basically just sort of speak the truth, don't they? But we kind of socialize them not to. We socialize them. I hope I'm socializing her to sugarcoat the truth. But maybe I'm not. Maybe I am socializing her to not say stuff. How is it that we learn silence? How do we do that with kids? What's the right way to try and guide them to a place of sugarcoating rather than just, I'm just not going to say it?
Yeah, and I actually would interrogate why we need to teach them to sugarcoat. And does sugarcoat actually mean what is appropriate or what would be well received or what keeps the peace? We are co-creating norms together. And, you know, part of the beauty of my work across continents and cultures is there are lots of different ways to do life and lots of different ways to communicate. But in workplaces, there is one particular dominant norm, or in families, there is one particular norm, and the gravity to mimic and to fit in is strong. I think that's why we teach our kids what is appropriate. Mm. And yet what is appropriate is also different. And the double standards are there. Someone saying something, if another person says the same thing, they might be, you know, a man says something pretty direct and they are demonstrating leadership potential. And a woman says something and she's overly aggressive or she's a bitch, right? So then what do we do in terms of teaching our kids? Where I would land is, what is the purpose here and how do we maintain your individual thought rather than, I think a lot of times kids learn silence in school.
Yeah.
You know, you need to fit inside the box. Creativity gets stripped out. Curiosity gets stripped out. Critical thinking gets stripped out because you're just regurgitating you know, and we're teaching to the test, and there's a whole systemic issue behind it. And I say that with great compassion and appreciation for our teachers. And in our interactions as we're raising our kids, how do we cultivate the sense that you can be who you are, you can be who you want to be, you can be you rather than having to be me or having to be like fill in the blank person. And to me, that's maintaining agency while balancing it with the reality that we all live together and we coexist. So you are also, part of your agency is also responsibility to understand the impact that you're having on other people. And I would hope that that leads to kindness and grace and a balanced bit, not over rotating one way or the other where you lose your own sense of self.
Yeah, I mean, so what you're talking about, I don't know, by all means, please do correct me on this, but are we basically talking about being honest? Like, what's the difference between, you know, speaking up and being honest?
I'm not sure there's a huge difference, other than being honest is also being honest with yourself. So silence manifests in a couple of ways. Silence is the censorship of speech, where I don't say something in a conversation. It is also the silencing of my own needs, right? And I think motherhood teaches us this profoundly of, do you as a mother have needs? No, we don't consider that in the set of factors in our family or in our communities. And then last but not least, are there parts of our identities we need to hide? For example, in the workplace, often being a woman or being a mother is seen as a liability, because you're not going to be as dedicated. And so many of us hide or feel the need to hide the fact that we are mothers and to work as if we don't parent, and parent as if we don't work, and we burn ourselves out. So the silencing is on all those levels of editing out and diminishing the things that keep us whole and keep us alive. On the flip side, voice is both what we say in a meeting and it is how we move through the world. So do we have the freedom, the agency, the autonomy to be who we are and shape the world differently rather than just trying to fit in?
All right, Mickey here with an advert for BetterHelp Therapy Online. You all right? Such a small question and sometimes such a big question too, eh? Now, regular listeners will know I am no stranger to depression, and while over time, and with the help of some decent counselling and brilliant friends and family, I've established a toolkit to help when the constantly dripping tap of life gets a bit too much, that does not mean I am a stress-free human rainbow skipping through meadows. I mean, who is? We all carry around different stresses, big and small, and sometimes we can deal, and sometimes it's much harder to cope. Life, innit? Right now, I have a teenage puppy to deal with, and although I love her very, very much, she can be a lot. There, said it. And as quick a fix as it seemed to say, I'm fine, and push it all down into the big inside box and put that lid on. For me, that hasn't been a great long-term solution, in that if I don't get it off my chest, it will at some point come bubbling up, and it's never been one to pick its moments in a good way. I find talking means I can avoid it exploding out of me like a messy emotional volcano all over my nana's carpet. Also, during my various times in talk therapy, I discovered that saying something out loud or writing it down can make it seem much more manageable than allowing it to swirl around and grow ever bigger in my head. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. I've found knowing how to reach out is sometimes the toughest bit, but BetterHelp is entirely online. Boom. Which means it couldn't be easier. You just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a registered therapist, then work your sessions around your schedule. With more than 1,000 therapists in the UK already, BetterHelp can provide access to mental health professionals with a wide variety of expertise in mental health. Standard Issue listeners get 10% off their first month at betterhelp.com/standard. That's betterhelp.com/standard.
So you talk about the immigrant experience in particular, because you're Taiwanese, as you said, and you moved to the US as a child with your family. And I think that, like, this is quite a common experience amongst, you know, first generation, second generation, like children in immigrant families. You've got to work hard, you've got to keep your head down, don't argue, just do what they say, kind of thing. And this isn't not an argument, but a discussion that me and my daughter's dad have a lot, because my daughter's mixed, her dad is Afro-Caribbean, and he's always telling her that she has to kind of replicate this very specific type of politeness that I'm like, it's not, what are you talking about? Like, I don't, you know, and I'll be like, no, I want her to ask for what she wants. It's powerful to ask for what you want. She should ask for what she wants. And he's like, no, you don't understand, basically, because she will be seen as not being polite. So you're looking at it from your like white middle class perspective. I'm coming at it from a very different place. She needs to learn that the reality of the world for her will be different. And I'm like, well, that's bullshit. The system sucks. Like, she should be able to, you know, exist in the same world as me. And he's like, but she doesn't. So, you know, so it's kind of like a sort of point of tension that we come back to, which I think is interesting. And, you know, you talk about it from the immigrant experience, but of course it applies to other marginalized groups. I wondered if you could talk to me a little bit about the power dynamics behind silence.
Yeah, I will say in that situation, not to take sides between you and your child's father, but both and, right? It, and I have the same conversation because my husband is white from the Midwest in the United States and I am not. And so our son presents as not white because genetics. And I've had the conversation with him. You do not have the same privilege that your father does. Does that mean that I wish, that I don't wish things were different and that we won't stop pushing for change? No. It means you should have this piece of data that your daughter's father is offering because that is, it is a piece of data in a data set. But that is also why we continue to steward the influence we have to create a different future rather than letting the status quo be what it is, because the status quo will treat her differently, will treat my son differently, will treat me differently. And that is why we can't talk about silence without talking about power. Couple of principles around power. Power is invisible to the people who have it. You talk with CEOs who say, my hands are tied because the board won't let me do this. And everyone who is an employee in that company is saying, if you, the CEO, do not have power, then the rest of us are completely screwed. We also, as we inhabit those roles in the organizational or hierarchical power, forget that power comes with that role. So there's a disconnect between how we see ourselves. You know, I'm still Elaine. I feel like I mess up all the time, but people see me as, you know, managing partner or a lecturer on law, you know, all these things where I'm like, no, I'm human. So we fundamentally forget the power that we have, which, and we tend to focus on the power we don't have rather than the power that we have. And anytime there are, this is, you know, all the social science research around dominant identities and subordinated identities. If you have a dominant identity, meaning you're in a male dominated workforce, then being a man is the dominant identity. Being a woman is the subordinated identity. Anytime you carry a subordinated identity, it is inherently an uphill battle. You are more likely to be othered, more likely to be questioned. You're trying to figure out, how does the dominant norm work? What is it? And then do I have to conform to it in order to be accepted? And that's also where intersectionality comes into play, because it is race, it is gender, it is ability, it is class, it is education. And if you have been part of the dominant norm, carried dominant identities, you fundamentally do not understand or severely underestimate how hard it is to carry subordinated identities. And we frame the problem as imposter syndrome.
Yeah.
Or women, you lack confidence, you lack courage, so go fix yourselves. Rather than carrying a dominant identity means that I likely silence the people who carry subordinated identities.
Basically, what you're saying and what you talk about in the book as well is that we silence others as well, like unconsciously or otherwise. We silence others through maybe not recognizing or in some cases abusing our power, right? So let's assume we're all lovely people and we're doing it unconsciously for these purposes. Can you give us some tips on how to avoid doing this? Like, what do we do to make sure that we are letting everyone in the room have a fair crack at the whip, so to speak?
Yeah. In the book, I talk about 9 different ways that we unintentionally silence people. Let's start with 2 that are the lowest hanging fruit. 1, do not assume that everyone is like you. Which is sort of the way we operate and move through the world and then are constantly surprised of, wait, you don't like chamomile tea? Everybody loves chamomile tea. Right? That is it's a little bit of how we're wired and why we gravitate toward people who look and sound like us and act like us, because there's an ease to it. And how this shows up around speaking up is, if I do not find it difficult to speak up, I don't understand why it's so hard for you to do so. If I've never had a problem, and in part because my voice has always been normed because I carry dominant identities, I fundamentally underestimate how challenging it would be for someone in a different position with a different background, different life experience to say the same thing. So just that awareness that it can be hard for some people, and just because you don't see it that way, don't experience it that way, doesn't mean it doesn't exist, is one way that we can stop silencing people. The other is to lower the barriers to communication. And what I mean by that is, often we, in workplaces in particular, require people to talk a certain way in order to be heard. You have to speak in 3 succinct bullet points with no ums, just the right amount of emotion to show that you care and not that you're robotic, but not too much emotion that you lose credibility. And if that's the prerequisite for having your voice heard, we are silencing people who are wired differently, who might think better by typing than talking, who are post-processors. And what I mean by that is, there are real-time processors who think best by talking things out in the moment. Yeah. And then there are those of us who, in the meeting, we can't quite figure out what to say. It feels like I've missed my shot. And then 20 minutes after the meeting, it's like, oh, that's what I wanted to say. How do we acknowledge that we are all wired differently? Well, we actively design our communication flows to optimize for voice. So Jen, it's easier for you to communicate your thoughts by typing. Fantastic. Shoot me a note. If I need clarification, maybe we'll talk in real time, but we tend to prioritize real-time communication over asynchronous communication to say that people who can talk in real time are better leaders, better professionals, better people than people who type or communicate asynchronously. That difference in wiring is seen as weakness rather than difference. So designing the way that we communicate is one way that we can actually support voice rather than silence people, incline them towards silence.
Well, that's interesting. That's an interesting point, because, you know, you talk about that kind of like power dynamic. It is, for various different reasons, harder for women to speak up in some situations, partly because you see what's happened to other people who've done it, partly because of society. But also, if you think about it, in the workplace, women are more likely to be the people to be trying to use flexible working, for example, working from home, missing out on those kind of like face-to-face real-time moments. So then that's another way in which women, I guess, are impacted. I wonder if you could talk to me a little bit about, for women particularly, because I really, really love that point you made about imposter syndrome, like, you're the problem. It's because you don't think you're good enough, rather than I don't actually give you the opportunity. Can you tell me a little bit, sort of specifically with reference to women, how do we unlearn silence? How do we speak up?
For anyone who has not read Ruchika Toshan's Harvard Business Review article on Stop Telling Women They Have Imposter Syndrome, go read it now.
I'm going to.
Yeah.
As soon because as this finishes, Google.
The fundamental premise is, we are imposters because we are not white men in a world designed in corporate for white men who have full-time wives, caretakers, who handle all of the childcare and all the household responsibilities. So for me, the first place to start for women is being sober-minded and clear-minded about the actual problem, because it has been framed as a women, you are deficient. You need to go fix yourself, which is where we started with this conversation of, instead of women, you need to speak up. To me, it is, can we be clear about what is our work to do? Are there ways in which I'm silencing myself, in which I am not as clear as I think I am? And so in the book, I talk about mitigated speech and levels of directness. Are there ways that I self-censor? What are my operating assumptions about who gets to speak? All of those things are pieces of work we can actually do. And there is work for the people around us to do, to create policies that actually support people who have caregiving responsibilities, because we disproportionately carry caregiving responsibilities and unpaid labor in the world. Can people have a broader definition of what leadership looks and sounds like? You know, there's a whole debate of whether tears are okay at work. And of course, women, you know, there's yeah. research around women and inclinations toward. And for me, you know, every time I teach about feedback, I disclose that I'm a crier, because I want to normalize that tears are a human emotion. It is one way of release. And of the releases in the world, it is one of the less destructive ones.
Sure, yeah.
So how do we build different norms over time for what is acceptable behavior? And that is not work for women to do alone. So whenever I talk about silence, so often it is pigeonholed as a woman's issue. Women need to unlearn silence. Well, we can, but if the leaders, the men around us refuse to hear us, there's only so much we can do. And to me, it is our collective responsibility to co-create a world in which women get to thrive or have the opportunity to thrive, which means, is there room for my needs? Is there room for my thoughts? Is there clarity in decision-making versus when I'm consulted or informed? Can you see my version of communication as just as valid and acceptable as the traditional norm? That's the collective work we all have to do. And that, to me, is why silence is a leadership issue, not a woman's issue. That's why we need to examine our policies and practices and the systems we're part of, to be at least intellectually honest that our policies and practices don't impact people the same way. Then we can ask the question, who does this support? Who does this silence? And what do we want to be? Rather than saying, well, women, you just need to work harder and get better. Then maybe we'll accept you.
Oh, Elaine, I could talk to you about this all day, but unfortunately, I can't. Unlearning Silence, How to Speak Your Mind, Unleash Talent, and Lead with Courage is available now, published by Cornerstone. Elaine, where can we find you on social media if we want to follow what else you're up to and keep up to date with any other top tips you might be putting out into the world about how we can all make the system better?
Yeah, I am Elaine Lynn Herring on LinkedIn and Instagram. And I have a monthly newsletter that goes straight to your inbox where your manager can't see it if your manager's on LinkedIn, with tips on how to use your voice and build cultures of voice.
That's fantastic. Elaine, thank you so much for joining me. This has been really interesting.
Thanks for having me.
Standard Issue, for all women.